As we are in this day and age, I have to be called a manager, so I'm the library manager. It depends who I'm writing the report for, whether I call myself library manager or city librarian. There is a subtle difference if you think about it. I would like to take this opportunity of extending a very warm welcome to all of you. We're very honoured to have such a select group of individuals tonight. It's wonderful. I, if you wouldn't mind, would like to obviously welcome John and Margaret, who will come and introduce themselves, etc., shortly. But I'd like to particularly identify a colleague of mine, Chris Sike, who has just been appointed the Turnbull Librarian in Wellington. So, Chris, why don't you stand up and let them see you? Wonderful occasion, both for the library but for me personally, because I can certainly confess IT is not one of the things that I go home and read at night. I read novels, but I don't have a laptop beside my bed. But I have, over the last 12 months, if not longer, been absolutely fascinated in the development of digital resources, and in our case, what's called the Digital Library, which will be unveiled to you tonight. And I would like, with your indulgence, just to identify a group of individuals who have worked extremely hard on this, and I'm holding wood, so I'm trusting that all will go well this evening, and that I will not cast the commentator's spell upon the proceedings. I'd like to firstly highlight the fact that one of our senior members of staff, Philip Ralphick, who's in charge of the New Zealand Pacific area, in partnership with Leslie Courtney, who is a city archivist, demonstrated very clearly not only to our own staff and the local community, but I think the community of New Zealand, that although archives and librarianship are two different disciplines, there's absolutely no reason why they can't share a line and get on with things. And these two have demonstrated this capacity for on a regular basis over the whole project. It is, for those of you who think I'm being a bit flippant, there is a school of thought that says the two are very separate and the twain shall never come together. Tonight we'll demonstrate to you that that's nonsense. There's no reason why they can't come together. I'd also like to just mention the team that were responsible for this. They included Robin, Mary, Stuart, Warwick, and Barbara, and obviously Philippa and Leslie. We also received excellent help from our council IT people and Michael Graphics, who are a firm down in Tower, who were responsible for assisting us with a lot of the work behind the scenes, which will be demonstrated to you this evening. So that's, I just want to thank those people in anticipation of what's to come. It's been a wonderful effort. It's involved a lot of work. We still keep the doors open. We still concentrate on our first task, which is service to the public coming through the door. But behind the scenes, they've worked away very hard on leading to this occasion. Margaret, I would like to just say to you, Margaret Tennant, Professor of History previously, now the Dean of the Graduate Research School at Massey, how grateful I am to you for the support that you have provided to the City Library over the years that you and I have been together. Tonight is very much part and parcel of your influence in lots of ways. It's you and I that weren't finding the city archivist that we've got today. It was you and I that talked about setting up a heritage trust with some wonderful support from Brian Elwood. And that has all come, you know, around at different times over the last few years. But I would, just before introducing you, like to say on behalf of the library how much we appreciate everything you've done for us. And we really are grateful for that. And so I invite you to come up and introduce us. And I hope that you all have a splendid evening. If you, I suppose I should do those things, what do you call them, house rules or house things. If anybody needs a loo, you just go to the back. back, one of the staff will direct you down to the door. If you need to leave early, we can assist you with that. If there's a fire alarm, which hopefully there won't be, there is a fire door just by where Stuart is. That's Stuart, one of the very helpful people in the city. There's a door out there, and there's also another door there. We hope you won't need anything like that. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope you have a splendid evening. Thank you.
People in our community that are interested in history and its many guides. I'd love to see people like you coming together on these occasions. It's also a particular pleasure for me tonight to introduce and to welcome Dr. Jock Phillips, who I think is one of the most entrepreneurial historians in this country. When I look at all the things that Jock's actually initiated, it's absolutely astonishing. Jock came, I first knew Jock as an academic historian. He became an associate professor in the Department of History at Victoria University. But he took a risk in leaving the safe confines of academia to go and become a chief historian of what
was just give that one to get the tape recorder out of our class.
And he really transformed the history branch of the Department of Internal Affairs. He was responsible for decommissioning a whole range of histories of organisations, government departments, where these organisations and departments actually paid the branch to supervise the writing of some very impressive histories over the 1990s and into the 2000s. That wasn't enough, though. He then got very interested in the electronic delivery of history and access to resources. Now, some of us in these state history departments are a bit sceptical about this. But he did go on to promote the idea, first of all, of putting the Dictionary Museum into the biography online with some assistance from the New Zealand Historical Association, which was then the executive was then based in Hunsdon. And that proved to be a very successful venture, and I assume some of you had clicked on the DNZB website to follow up on the biographies on it. He then started to promote the idea of an electronic encyclopedia of New Zealand. And when the position of editor was advertised, he, of course, was the obvious person to get it. And the electronic encyclopedia of Ziara has gradually been wound out on this website and various phases of it, beginning with the settlement of New Zealand and more recently moving on to some of the natural environment. Available to New Zealanders. There's been offshoot books associated with it as well, and they're also highly impressive and of tremendous use. Jock himself is a very, is a historian of considerable renown in his own right, of course, and his history of masculinity in New Zealand, a man's country, is one that's really become a classic and is still very often referred to. I had to write a study guide.
Jock's book was brought off the shelf yet again and became a fundamental resource for the section there on masculinity. He's also written a number of, well, I think it's about 13 books now, but the ones that particularly stick in my mind are those to do with the settlement of New Zealand, and he's got a book coming out on that later on this year. He's written a lovely history of the Royal Tour of New Zealand in the early 1950s. A beautiful book. He's written on the monument, the war monuments in New Zealand. But the thing about Jock is that he's not one of those historians who's self-centred either, who's interested in only promoting himself. He's one of those historians who's facilitated others' careers, and these opportunities he's provided, both as chief historian and more recently as the editor of Te Ara, have resulted in historians being trained into a variety of skills, both traditional and non-traditional, and opening up a huge range of opportunities for others. So, Jock, it's a great pleasure to welcome you tonight. You're the obvious person to launch Pātika Ipurangi, and but also to link this with your own projects. So, welcome.
Nā reo, tēnā mana, tēnā iwi o te motu, tēnā koutou katoa. Well, thank you very much, Margaret, for that unnecessarily enthusiastic welcome. I hardly recognise myself, I have to say. but it's very, really a great privilege to be here tonight for the unveiling of this particular project. I always enjoy coming to Palmerston North. There's a famous Palmerston North poet, Bill Oliver, who once wrote a poem entitled Walking in the Fields of My Father's Youth. And when I come to Palmerston North, I always feel as if I'm walking in the fields of my father's youth, because my father was actually living in Whanganui when his father was drowned in the Whanganui River. My father was 7, and his mother was just working in a hotel. She was poverty-stricken, really. It was the midst of the Depression. And he got boarded with families right through the Manawatū, but particularly in the Palmerston North area, went off to Palmerston North Boys High School. When he went to Palmerston North Boys High School, he hadn't got any shoes, so he used to tell me, and the local teacher provided him with shoes. But he basically got a start in life in this city. So I always have a sense of gratitude sort of fascination about what it must have been like for him to walk around these streets in the 1920s and the 1930s. Well, fortunately, of course, now we will have a much better sense of what it is to walk around these streets in the 1920s and the 1930s because of the launch of Pātika Ipurangi. I must say, I happened to spend a couple of hours looking through it the other day. We were actually about to find images for a entry on Te Ara about horses. And so I decided to do a search on horses, and I came across some great images. And then when I arrived here tonight, I picked up this fabulous image and thought, how come I missed that one? Until I looked on the back and found, lo and behold, it's a donkey. So I should remember next time to put the word donkey into the search engine. Why I think it's important, really, is that once you put those images onto the web, two things happen. They suddenly become accessible to the local community. And it really, really is important, it seems to me, to inspire people in the local community about their own history. Not only because it gives people a sense of their own traditions, their own roots, a sense that this place has been peopled for a long time, and it creates a real dedication, I think, to conservation and the preservation of tradition. So it has a great local function, but once it goes on the web, it also has an absolutely universal function. Because before very long, this great, enormous, universal gobbler called Google will pick it up, and lo and behold, when people look for horses in Madison, Wisconsin, or somewhere in the middle of France, they're likely to hit on an image of horses in Palmerston North, and suddenly the world is open to you. On Te Ara, on the Encyclopedia of New Zealand, now something like 60% of our users hit on that site from outside New Zealand. So that once things are digitised, they serve this great local purpose, but they also serve a great international purpose. I thought tonight that I was asked to talk about Te Ara, and I felt a little bit nervous about this. This is actually the third time I've talked about Te Ara in Palmerston North, and I had a faint sort of anxiety about overexposure. And there's also a problem that we now have something like 360 entries, as we call them, on the encyclopedia. There's over 1 million words, and there's something like 11,000 images. So it's pretty hard in a space of about 25 minutes to give you a taste of that. So I thought what I would do is give you a very brief overview of what you can find on Te Ara, and then give you a little bit more richer taste of our latest theme on the bush. So let me get onto the web and see how we go. Okay. This is our homepage, and what we decided to do was to create a complete encyclopedia of New Zealand on the web. Now, obviously, that's not a short-term project. In fact, this thing is probably going to end up taking about 9 years to do. And so we'd realised that people were going to have problems expecting a complete encyclopedia and not having one. So we did two things. We gave them a complete encyclopedia, which was the old 1966 encyclopedia, which probably many of you have in those three-volumed sets sitting on your shelves. And I must say, one of the great joys of doing this project has been the way putting that resource on the web has suddenly given a completely new life to it. And in fact, I came across a little book the other day about the history of dueling in New Zealand. And I read the first part of it. It's a lovely book. And found, lo and behold, that it had been inspired by the entry about dueling in the old 1966 encyclopedia. What we also did was decided just to keep people at bay, so to speak, is to do a little overview of New Zealand in brief, so to speak. And so the normal categories, I guess, are to be found there. Then we decided to unveil some of the themes, and we're basically going to do the whole of New Zealand in 9 themes, which is intellectually quite a challenge. How do you divide New Zealand up? And we decided in the end to do it under 9 themes, and to begin with themes on the people of New Zealand, really as a way of introducing everybody to everybody else. And there were really 2 parts to that, one on Māori peoples of New Zealand, and as you can see, each of the major iwi of the country has their own entry. The obvious place to go to here, of course, is Rangatāne, a lovely entry written by Mason and Maihana Duri, who may well be known to a few people in this room. And in addition, we did a kind of parallel set of entries all about the peoples of New Zealand, different communities, which ranged, as you can see down this list on the side or on this map up here, from those who came from the British Isles in large numbers, obviously from the English, the Scots, the Irish and so forth. And just to follow up with a little bit of advertising and my entrepreneurial spirit, as Margaret said, I've just published a book, in fact came out this week, on the history of migration from England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, called Settlers. So some of their findings in that book were based very much on, were presented in an earlier form in this entry. For example, if one looks at this section of the English entry, all about people who came to New Zealand from England, here you'll find a map which talks about what parts of England sent large numbers of people to New Zealand. All of those figures derive from this project that we did, and it's now come out as a book on the settlers of New Zealand. Now, the second theme we launched was a thing called Earth, Sea and Sky, and this gives you some idea of the kind of range of areas that we covered, really from everything to do with the marine world, things to do with the sky, which was basically about the climate and the atmosphere and so forth. A great collection of entries which we just put out as a book on natural disasters. I thought I might just go to one on historic earthquakes and look at the most famous earthquake, I suppose, 1931 earthquake, and just to see what that would have felt like if you'd been in Palmerston North on in February the 3rd at 10:47. And this is what it would have felt like in Palmerston. It would have been what is called level 6 on the Mercalli scale, felt by all. People and animals alarmed, difficulty in walking steadily, objects falled from the shelves, unstable furniture tipped over, slight damage to some masonry buildings, and weak chimneys damaged. So that was Palmerston on February the 3rd, 1931. And then what we have done is also, while we've been unrolling these themes, is also done a sort of tiki tour, started doing a tiki tour of New Zealand, by looking at the different places of New Zealand. And obviously, we decided that Manawatū was one of those that would be early up on the scene. And sure enough, what you'll find is a lovely entry done by Malcolm McKinnon on Manawatū. It's got two parts. It's got a section about, which is a sort of detailed gazetteer of the Manawatū. And there's also a overview about Manawatū and Horowhenua. And as you can see from the entries here, it's a complete history, it's a complete geography, and it includes wonderful sort of interactive things such as this map, which I always enjoy, which when it's presented on the screen is initially a standard map, but you click this and you get the landforms, click that and you get the highways, and click that and you get the vegetation. So I hope some of you have looked at that introduction to Manawatū. But what I really want to talk about tonight is the theme that we introduced late last year on the bush. Now, this might seem an odd thing, really, for a historian to talk about, because this was primarily written by scientists. And yet, when it was a great experience for me, I must say, as a historian, to work with all these scientists. It made me realise that actually the rigour of scientists leaves us historians considerably behind the eight ball. But what I found most interesting was that it totally and completely expanded my sense of history. And I began to realise that when we taught conventional histories of New Zealand, beginning in 1300 or thereabouts, or even worse, beginning in 1840. In fact, we were far from the mark. So I'm going to tell you another kind of history, and I'm going to do it through this series of entries. There are 106 entries, something like 300,000 words, all about the bush and people's interaction with the bush. Now, the story, as I've said, doesn't begin in 1300. It actually begins round about 85 million years ago. And it begins with this experience. If we stop round about there. And at this point in time, what subsequently became New Zealand breaks away from the Gondwana continent. At this point in time, as you can see, it's way, way down in the Antarctic. We're a long, long way south. And then over the next 85 million years, this is what happens. The landmass separates, moves further north, and so modern New Zealand arrives. Now, what the implication of that was that for 85 million years, this little landmass was alone on an increasingly larger and pretty lonely sea. And the result of that was that you got a quite remarkable ecology develop in New Zealand. Those animals that had existed on Gondwana and split off were left to evolve in their own kinds of ways. So, for example, we got this remarkable animal. The tuatara. Can I get some sound?
This prehistoric predator is unique. Tuatara lived long before the dinosaurs. And although they roamed the world unchanged for 200 million years, New Zealand is now the only place where these living fossils survive.
Equally remarkable was something which, to be quite honest, I had never, ever heard of before, and that is this weird Gondwana ancestor, the Peripatus, one of New Zealand's strangest beasts, which basically survives by spitting on its prey. And this is the Peripatus. You'll find them, they're apparently quite common in vegetable gardens and also in forest floors, but I can't say I've ever seen one, but it really is a quite remarkable beast. So once you had that degree of isolation, the only things that could really get here and colonise the country were those things that could either float or fly. And some did. I mean, obviously, small things, particularly plants, for example, such as the orchids, could arrive. And so we began to evolve, again, some really beautiful native orchids, the green hood, which you see quite commonly in the bush, the spider orchid, and this bearded orchid, most beautiful of objects. But obviously the things which couldn't fly and the things which couldn't swim were kept out, and the result was that apart from the bats, we had no mammals, and even the short-tailed bat, which did arrive, very rapidly took to the ground and became more like a rodent than a bat because there were no rodents with which it needed to compete. Again, it's an extraordinary animal. Its males actually compete for females by doing singing performances, and the one that sings the best gets the top lady. Without rodents or animals, the ground became a feeding place for other things, such, for example, as our extraordinarily rich collection of snails. And because they didn't have a lot of competition, they tended to become very, very large, such as the Paralephanta.
Paralephanta lays large, hard-shelled eggs. Like the kiwi, the incubation period is long. They take several months to hatch. But the most bizarre thing about these snails is that they eat flesh. At night, they drag large worms out of their holes. They make quite a feed.
And of course, the birds, without the competition of mammals, became, many of them, about a third of them, became ground dwellers. And because they were ground dwellers and they didn't have to fly, they became much heavier and became indeed much more like animals. The largest of them, of course, was the moa. And this is a wonderful entry by Trevor Worthy about the moa. It also includes, in the 19th century, of course, people got fascinated by the moa, particularly, of course, Richard Owen, and this famous photograph of Richard Owen, and they became fascinated by the size of the moa. And there was one individual down in Canterbury who became so fixated by the size of the moa that he actually put two together and turned it more into a giraffe than it is in a moa. But the fact is, of course, that size was one of the great characteristics of New Zealand animals, and particularly birds. We also had some very, very unusual environments in New Zealand. New Zealand had the fastest growing mountains in the world. The New Zealand mountains basically have only appeared in the last 5 million years. And they've appeared in isolation. And so the result is, we've got a nice little sort of interactive showing some of the mountains, which you can click on, obviously, like this. Because it was isolated, and because it was rapid, we developed some very strange species in the mountains. So, for example, we have the only alpine cicada. We have this giant wetter existing up on the alpine areas. And we have the only alpine lizard, this one which is in the Kaikoura ranges. And, of course, we have the most alpine parrot in the world. Can I get some sound on that one? Here we are.
For as much as 10 minutes, the couple prolong their mating. Unusual in the world of birds. It's a seldom seen display, a culmination of their gentle and devoted courtship.
So who says Kiwis are not great lovers? So the first part of this history is really the evolution of a quite remarkable ecology with some pretty weird species. The second part we tell in the bush comes with the arrival of Polynesian people around about 1300 AD, who explore the land. And we've got a lovely entry written by Rawiri Taunui down in Canterbury, all about the Māori exploration of the land with Rakai Hutu, the great South Island explorer here on the home page. Very quickly, of course, they learnt to use the bush. And we've got lovely entries about the way they used the bush to catch birds and the way they used the streams of the bush to catch eels. Even the eels were big, as you can see. And they developed a very rich mythology about the bush. Stories about Patupaira here, which you can see there. Also about Taniwha. And this entry has got some lovely images of 19th century images of Taniwha, such as this drawing of a Taniwha done in 1846. But of course the Taniwha takes many forms, and it also takes modern forms, such as this to be found in Northland. And then another group of people arrived, and they too set out to explore the bush. Many of them, in fact, owed a lot to the Māori who were already there. Many of the early explorers were basically, or at least the successful ones, were highly dependent upon Māori guides. Here's a good example of Bishop Selwyn crossing a swamp with the assistance of his Māori guides. Here's another one of J.T. Thompson crossing the Mataura in 1856, I think it is. Yep. In some ways, the most famous explorer, of course, was Thomas Brunner. And on the first of his voyages, he was accompanied by William Fox, the painter. So what we did was talk about his voyage by using some of the images which William Fox did on that famous journey. And here you'll see a little detail of that bird-catching image that we used before. In the same vein, we've drawn on the journal of Alphonse Barrington and tried to tell the story of his remarkable exploration at the head of the Wakatip. And as you can see, well, you might see, we've tried to do it by having a little fire where he camped and wrote his diary. But sometimes, unfortunately, the fire went out. So we tried to illustrate that as well. Pākehā too, of course, not only explored the bush, they also came to use the bush. They cut down trees, as you can see here, and they climbed up kauri trees in order to hunt for gum.
Here is Nick Yarkas, going to climb a giant kauri in search of cones. He's an expert climber, and in 20 years has never had a fall. The kauri was the pride of the New Zealand forest, and its timber famous for masts and spars. In the days before white men lived here, whaling ships came in their hundreds to cut kauri timber. Before he starts to let himself down, Nick has to make sure his rope is free, and he can break himself when he wants to. He's literally holding his life in his hands.
But apart from exploiting the bush, slightly Pākehā New Zealanders also came to enjoy the bush for its recreational possibilities. So we've got a nice series of entries all about bush and mountain recreation. I thought I might just show you a couple. This one on caving, because the images, I must say, underneath are absolutely wonderful. Here's a little sort of interactive about how caves are formed, which is rather nice. And then we've got these spectacular images of what it's actually like if you're brave enough or stupid enough to actually get down there. I must say, the images are enough for me, and they're pretty spectacular. Above the ground, they came to enjoy the rivers, and there's a nice entry all about canoeing and rafting. Again, I thought I might show you rather a delightful early film.
The most popular entertainment of the day are the canoe hurdle races. In this novel event, the women are as clever as the men, and there's quite a knack in putting a canoe over a hurdle. Yes, quite a knack. There's also the diving under method for men only. The water jump at the Grand National has nothing like this. The race goes not to the swift, but to the ones who can remount without capsizing or losing their paddles.
And rather more spectacular, some people, if we look in the landscape, a whole section about landscapes and an entry which I must say I decided to write. Someone said to me the other day, what do you know about waterfalls? And I said, well, I didn't know anything about waterfalls until I came to write this entry, which was a really enjoyable thing to write. And we tracked down this particular use of waterfalls in New Zealand.
The Hooker Falls on the Waikato River, some of our most spectacular white water, some of our most dangerous. Six kayakers, all experienced, they say, defied the power of nature.
Taking the plunge 8 meters straight down, drop vertical into a huge foamy piece of white water. This is what we go for.
It's like orgasm.
But of course, people's interaction with the bush was not without its costs. And we have 9 entries in here which talk about what the human impact has been on the land. Most obviously, of course, and one can see it in this entry, the coming of people led to the cutting down of trees. That is the forest cover in New Zealand in 1000 AD. That is the situation in 1840, and that is the situation today. They also, of course, brought in dangerous weeds. And I can't resist showing you this little clip.
What do you keep a lookout for? Well, flowers like this and fruits like this and vines like this, and they can grow 10 metres in a year. Real stranglers, and this one's strangling this poor old cabbage tree. A trim is not enough. We've got to destroy it in every way we can.
Old man's beard must go!
I must say, if doing this theme it convinced me of anything, it really was the incredible frailty of our ecology and the extraordinary costs of human occupation of these lands. We have an entry here about extinctions, which makes you realise that New Zealand is, I'm afraid to say, the world capital of extinctions. And we decided to actually list all those extinctions that have been recorded, when they occurred and by whom. And it's, as you can see, it's a long, long, long list. Well, let me end with one final example, which sort of sums up in some ways what I learnt as a historian and I guess as a New Zealander from doing this theme. And it is about our most famous bird, the kiwi. Because the kiwi, like many other birds in New Zealand, in a sense, in the absence of mammals, took on many of the features of mammals. So that if you look, for example, at the kiwi's feathers, here's a duck's feather, here's a kiwi's feather, and here is a rabbit's feather, and it's more like a rabbit than it is like a duck. And if you look at its nostrils, there's a kiwi's nostrils, there's a horse's nostrils, and there's a kia's nostrils, and the same is true. Because the kiwi did not fly, so it could become very much heavier. And you see this spectacularly represented, I guess, in this film about the birth of a kiwi.
She hasn't eaten for several days. This X-ray photograph shows the huge size of the egg. There's almost no room in the abdomen for food. Forming the egg has an enormous cost. She needs 3 times her normal intake of energy, yet still loses body weight with each laying.
So because the egg is so big, the baby kiwi is very highly developed when it appears. And at that point, the male kiwi takes over and incubates the egg. And by the time the kiwi hatches, the parents simply assume that it's able to fend for itself. So essentially, they let it fend for itself. Well, of course, that was all very well in a world without mammals. But in a world in which there are mammals, and in particular in which there are stoats, it's a terrible, terrible situation. And many of the species, particularly the okarito kiwi, as you know, there's only about 200 of them left. But as the kiwi disappeared from the bush, so in a sense it entered into national mythology. This is the famous cartoon, Trevor Lloyd cartoon, of their victory over the All Blacks in 1905. And by the middle part of the 20th century, there were kiwi blokes and kiwi sheilas eating kiwi foods, playing the kiwi golden kiwi lottery, having kiwi kitsch all over the place, eating kiwi bacon, and generally making the kiwi an outsize, hackneyed kind of symbol. And they even went to bed with this famous clip. Well, I hope that hasn't put you all to sleep, and I also hope that next time Television New Zealand makes a Good Night Kiwi, they know that Kiwis don't actually sleep at night, and they would certainly not sleep with a cat on their bed. So, thanks very much.
Weird, Jock, of your own ancestral links to Palmerston North. But one of the things that occurred to me in looking at Te Ao and the linkage that one can make with what's being launched tonight is how important for these developments are for those of us in some of the smaller centres. Whenever I've lived in Wellington for brief times, I've always envied those who could just walk down the hill to the Turnbull Library and do research or go and look through photograph collections. Now that more and more of this is available online, it's opening up possibilities for those of us who are away from the main centres, both to access collections that are in the main centres, but also for our materials, as we'll see, to be made available for others, and hopefully to shift some of the focus of history away from the main centres in New Zealand to what the provinces had to contribute to New Zealand's history. So, Jock, thank you for the fascinating insight tonight. I'd seen some of those clips before, but some I hadn't, and I'm definitely going to go back now and go right through the natural history entry in Te Ara. And so now I'll hand over to library staff. We're going to talk about our own digital materials. So thank you again, Jock.